interview with Adi Karam, 15th of July, 1966.
What's the date today? 15th of July. And just for the record, I mean, what year did you become a DL?
1963.
In fact, I was going to ask you something about your training. Did you receive any sort of training?
We had a small training, a very short period of training in irrigation work and survey.
Did that help you much?
It has been very useful, but then just got a hang on what is happening, very short training.
No, I was wondering whether they had too much of this trial and error process of thrusting you into the field.
Yes, now, at the time that we joined, except for the civil servants,
yes,
there was no systematic training as such.
Mm-hmm.
So all officers who were recruited went straight onto the field, and they learned it the hard way by coming across problems and then finding the solutions for them.
Do you personally prefer this sort of system or systematic training?
No, I think a systematic training is much better.
And I alluded to this question of rural backgrounds earlier. Now, most of the DLOs of your period, the early 50s and mid 50s, would have been Colombo chaps. How do you think they fit into this sort of job?
Well, I suppose, apart from not only the DLOs, most of the other administrative officers,
mm-hmm,
who had everything to do with provincial administration of that type. And I believe as they came across the problems, they had to learn,
mm-hmm,
the ways of tackling them.
But doesn't it make things more difficult both for them and for the people?
It is, I
think so. What specific advantages would there be in having a chap with a rural background and some sort of agricultural knowledge?
Because naturally he will be in a better position,
mm-hmm,
to understand what a man's problem would be,
mm-hmm,
and then in finding a solution to it. Because he will be always looking at the problem from the angle of the person who has the problem.
Mm-hmm. And in other words, he would be able to establish a better rapport with the peasantry. Turning to these questions here and this land development ordinance proper, what is the term that is commonly used by the peasants to indicate this type of tenure?
We generally say Baduidam.
Baduidam. But doesn't that give a false notion?
It does. Now, Baduidam, actually, when you lease out land under the Crown Lands Ordinance, that is real Baduidam. But this is a restricted form of tenure.
Mm-hmm. I have tried to call it conditional freehold here, but on the other hand, looking at it again, I wonder whether that isn't a contradiction in terms, conditional freehold.
It's very difficult to find actually a correct term for this.
What about the phrase used in the ordinance itself, protected holding?
Protected holding, yes. Generally, it's referred to as LDO land.
No, because I was wondering whether the use of this term Baduidam contributed towards a misunderstanding of by the peasant.
Definitely, not only the peasant, even their confusion for anybody else, even for officers.
Oh, I see.
In fact, now there is no proper term, a correct term to describe the settlement in Singapore. They use all that, now they prefer to even a VE settlement as Janapati. Janapati is completely different. Now, Janapati is generally referred to as colonization scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But they refer to VE settlements also as Janapati.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had tried my best to get a more satisfactory single term to describe settlement.
Mm-hmm. I suppose you have... I suppose you have had to allocate land on numerous occasions. both for village expansion and colonization?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And now, how did you, in your period, how were you expected to choose people? Since there were more applicants than land available, on what basis did you choose?
Now, both for village expansion and colonization, we select the people at land catchery.
Yes.
Land catchery is given due publicity, generally at least 30 days. Uh-huh. And the people assemble there. Uh-huh. At the land catchery, the government officials who have direct dealings with the villagers, that is the Grama Sevaka or the Hetman, those days. Then the SLDO, the OLDO are present. In addition, we always invite the VC member, representatives from the Rural Development Society, who also know the people intimately.
Mm-hmm.
And because all their particulars are collected in public, generally there isn't very much of an error in the information that is given.
Do you find peasants are ready to come forward and object to someone's claims on the ground of that he's exaggerating or so on?
Generally they do not, because they do not want to lose their goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
But there are occasions also when they come out, immediately in such instances, the party is angry. But as long as the relationships are good, they generally don't come forward and say, so-and-so has land, but the information given is incorrect.
What chance has a village bully or the headman and his group of keeping the others quiet and, you know, getting away with something?
Well, that is also not impossible. But generally, if they apply at the land catchery,
mm-hmm.
well, it is not so easy for the headman to suppress the information.
Mm-hmm.
Because the headman will, on the one hand, be frightened that there will be petitions against him.
Yes.
That's one aspect of it. And even open abuse.
And from the instructions you got from your superiors, who were you expected to choose? You were expected to choose the poorest or the...
Now, particularly in the case of colonization schemes, in addition to landlessness, we are also expected to select people who have an inclination and ability for agriculture.
Yes.
But in practice, that is not possible. For one thing, that is a very difficult thing to determine. Well, who is a good cultivator and who is not? It's only the local villagers who will know. So, although they expect to give a certain amount of emphasis to this ability for cultivation, in practice, it really does not happen.
Yes.
So, the decision is mainly on two factors, the land owned by the applicant and the size of his family.
Mm-hmm. For instance, it would not be possible, say, in a case of colonization schemes, for a village trade or someone with very loose roots in the land to get land.
Generally, it does not happen because the number of applicants would be so large that we would eliminate traders and other people who are not really peasants.
Yes, I see. Now, a village expansion, I can see that it's easier to keep a check, but when you have colonization, applicants for a colonization scheme, and where it's the case of applications from several districts and island-wide, how does one choose?
No, but even in those cases, although they say maybe island-wide, maybe in some other districts, but the officers holding the land catchery go to the area and get the local people together.
Together?
Yes.
What is the role of the DROs? Haven't they to check some information sometimes? Some of the information?
They do not personally check. Actually, the checking of the information is done by the Grama Sevaka.
Mm-hmm.
The general practice that is adopted is, now applications are directly received by the catchery.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the purpose is to avoid any complaints that applications have been either misplaced or destroyed by angry party.
Mm-hmm.
So we invite applications direct to the catchery. Once the applications are received, we number them and forward them to the DRO to be scheduled. The information given in the application to be checked and scheduled.
Mm-hmm. And so he does it through the Grama Sevaka?
He sends those to the respective, he breaks up the applications according to the Grama Sevaka division and sends them to the Grama Sevaka.
Mm-hmm.
The Grama Sevaka is expected to check on the information, schedule the information and bring it at the land catchery.
The Grama Sevaka is the correspondent to the village headman or?
Village headman. It exactly corresponds to the village headman, but of course now with the growth of population, certain village headman divisions have been subdivided into more 2 or 3 Grama Sevaka divisions.
I was wondering how it had happened then, that in this case, Pul Elia, in this is a case of village expansion.
Yeah.
All the new Baduidam lots, the new LDO tenures, had gone to the richer, better off sections of the village. That's what Leach complains about.
It is rather strange because now I must have held thousands and thousands of land catches.
Yes.
But generally, as far as my land catches were concerned, for one thing, there have been hardly any appeals against the decisions. And even in the case of those where there had been appeals, on further investigation, we found that the position that I had taken and the selection that I had made was about the fairer.
And he, Leach again, criticizes this fact that in this case, in the early 50s, they chose, in the late 40s I presume, they chose, they asked the village admin to provide lists of people with less than 1 acre, and chose from that list. And he says that on this basis, you couldn't prevent the son of a rich person getting land. But I wonder whether that was rigidly followed.
So there is one thing now. The times are also different.
Yes.
The 1940s
yes.
were distinctly different from now.
Oh.
Now those were days when the headman had a very much bigger say in the villages, and any headman could have turned around and to a chapter said, you shut up and keep quiet, don't come out with anything.
Oh.
So
how do you know this? I mean...
Well, this has happened.
Oh, I see.
You see? So in those days, in the 1950s, 40s, well, it was not impossible that a certain amount of facts could have been suppressed,
mm-hmm.
but it generally does not happen today. Today, of course, times have changed and they are not, for one thing, the grammar servers do not have the same hold on the people as then, so that they cannot use so much of influence. That
yes.
probably may be the factor.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it would vary from village to village. Even in those days, it need not have prevailed generally.
Now, that is generally found in colonization schemes, and it's a general belief also that the most undesirable people in the villages have been dispatched to the colonization schemes.
The older colonization?
In the older colonization schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, the same allegation of course is made even in the present, in the case of present colonization schemes, but the chances are not so much as those days. But I think it is a general truth that in the good old days,
mm-hmm.
particularly, all the undesirables were disposed of in the colonization schemes by the headman and other people concerned. In fact, the villagers, even if the people who were selected were better off than them, they really liked the idea of the undesirables getting out of the village.
Mm-hmm.
That partly accounts for all this unnecessary trouble in this colonization schemes, because my experience has been that generally the ordinary colonists is not the normal type of villages. So even if in a colonization scheme you have 75% normal villages and 25% bad chaps, or even if the percentage of the bad chaps is smaller than that person, generally the good chaps also get spoiled by this bad luck.
Regarding the third question, I suppose nowadays there is never enough land to give to richer people.
Definitely not. Except this very recent thing of granting land to commercial firms and for food production purposes and the special leases.
You haven't had any experience of middle class colonies?
I have.
Oh, where?
Well, in Trincomalee and Mathali districts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Trincomalee it was an absolute block. In Mathali also, of the land that had been given on the middle class, only 4 allottees made a success.
Out of
I think about 30 or 40.
Why?
That's the main reason is, now I have come to this conclusion that large blocks of land cannot be developed by middle class people. Middle class people are people of limited means, so they do not have the necessary capital to invest on the land.
And they tend to share crops.
Well, even if they are able to cultivate the land, they will have to get it cultivated by the sharecropping and other methods.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot employ labor, invest money on the land, and develop it by themselves. The main thing is capital. And under this middle class alienation, they can only get loans once they get a grant for the middle class.
Yeah.
Not before that, but really the capital is required before that stage.
Have some of these middle class people simply taken the timber and sold it and then abandoned it?
In a majority of the cases, it has been so.
In fact, coming back to the early question of the title of Baduibar, question 5 pertains to that. You see, did the peasants realize that they were getting freehold? Do they realize it? So comes in virtually, which is virtually freehold.
Generally they do, but they still feel that the government has too much of a hold on this land. I do not know whether it is due to the intervention of government officials in administration,
mm-hmm.
but probably because of that reason, they still feel the government has too much of an interest in the land. Well, I for one, I have always tried to emphasize at every stage to these people that it is their land. As long as there is no breach of any of the conditions, that it is very similar to private land,
mm-hmm.
and that they should always consider it so. But somehow or other, probably as I say, due to the intervention of too much of government officials, they see this as crown land.
This is the traditional independence of the Sinhalese peasantry, isn't it? They have always been rather independent. I mean, they don't like too much interference.
Yes, that is so.
And what about this question of sharecropping arrangements? I mean, even coming back to the earlier question, isn't there a difference between village expansion and colonization schemes? In colonization schemes, there is greater government supervision. Is that correct?
Yes, there is greater government supervision. And of course, the aim of colonization is to give the settler the entire means of livelihood out of that thing. But in the case of VE schemes, generally, it is not for the entire life.
Mm.
Generally, in and around towns, it is mainly for the purpose of housing.
Mm.
And even in other areas, it is the land that is alienated is either not sufficient or not so suitable to give them sufficient income.
Mm-hmm.
So what is expected is they'll partly work on the land and then find other means of livelihood.
So in that case, if there's much less interference in village expansion schemes, in those areas, do they still feel that there is too much interference? Does this feeling apply to village expansion areas as well as colonization schemes?
In neither place do they feel that there is too much interference. But because officers go to these lands, they have direct dealings with them, the people feel that it is not their own land. That is why. Otherwise, they do not feel that they are being interfered with too much. In fact, the one aspect of that, of the government getting the officers to go on to these lands and because of their interest in this thing, they begin to depend too much on the government.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a question I was going to come to. I think I'll take it later. What about, now, under the land development ordinance, one of the purposes was to prevent subdivision of lands. And I think they also didn't like sharecropping. I mean, the architects of the ordinance didn't want sharecropping. But in actual practice, doesn't sharecropping prevail?
It prevails. In colonization schemes mainly.
Not in village expansion?
Not in village expansion.
Okay, those are building sites.
There again, it's not. Now, it depends on the area. Now, say for instance, in Kani district,
mm-hmm.
the majority of village expansion schemes
mm-hmm.
are either quarter acre or half acre allotment,
mm-hmm.
and mainly for housing. All that they can do is, after constructing their house in and around whatever balance space that is there, they can plant a few plants like orange,
mm-hmm.
and one or two plants like that.
Yes, I see.
But in the case of, the dry zone area, it is for cultivation.
Mm-hmm. And in that case, do they do it by sharecropping or do they do it themselves in village expansion?
No, in village expansion schemes where the unit of alienation is one or 2 acres, they don't do any sharecropping, they themselves cultivate it.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the proximity of the land also helps
it? Yes, helps it. But this business of sharecropping you generally get in colonization schemes where the unit of alienation is more than 3 acres. And that is one of the reasons why...
3 acres of paddy.
3 acres of paddy. And that is one of the main reasons why the government has decided to reduce the unit to 2 acres paddy and 1 1/3 acres highland. Because they feel that a normal peasant family cannot by themselves cultivate more than that.
When did they reduce this? 1950?
Some 1960.
Oh, I see. Funny thing is that in the 30s I discovered, they thought that one family could quite easily manage 5 acres of paddy, which is incorrect.
That is, I believe they, that was for broadcast cultivation. Oh, cultivation by broadcasting and not by using improved methods.
Are they using improved methods?
Now, of course, people are used to this improved method of cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, they adopt it. Now, I find in Minipay, there are some of these people who let out their paddy lands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the lessees are generally mudalalis, and they get a large extent. They get a few allotments, 3, 4, 5, up to 10 or even 15.
Yes.
So those people use tractors and broadcast and therefore do not use improved methods because it is extensive cultivation. Otherwise, the allottees or the colonists who cultivate their own fields, they generally adopt improved methods.
So in that case, farmer is correct in saying that Ande was probably invoked in most of the colonies.
He is correct.
But in this sense then, the people who have received the land are going against the intentions of its framers.
Yes. And it's a very difficult thing to control. With the human factor enters into it so much. Now, it really goes in a vicious circle. Now, mainly when you get the wrong type of man who is not used to proper cultivation,
mm-hmm.
he seeks the easier course of just letting it out to somebody on Nandi.
Mm-hmm.
Or getting somebody else to cultivate for some, according to some system of sharecropping. And then he prefers to take that little income now. Because the income is not sufficient from the land, by the next season, he is in more difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So he inevitably raises a loan and gives out the paddy plot completely to somebody else for cultivation. And for him, he gets a smaller share than what he got the previous season.
Oh, I see.
So like that, it goes on.
Are these sort of conceived sharecropping arrangements difficult to detect?
It's very difficult to detect because the people who lease out these paddy lands do not come forward,
mm-hmm.
the real cultivators.
Are they open about it? Sometimes do they sort of quite openly sharecrop the land and don't bother to even to hide it from the officers?
Generally, they know that it's a breach of condition of the permit,
mm-hmm.
and they do not like to let it out. They try as much as possible to hide the fact.
Isn't it correct to say that officers on the whole don't look at this sort of thing as very serious, as distinct from abandoning the land and other practices? They don't object to sharecropping?
No, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in colonization schemes, naturally a person who lets out his paddy allotment
mm-hmm.
is not in a position to pay the annual payment. So, the general observation is that when it comes to the collection of annual payments, you can easily observe all these chaps who are not paying. Invariably, those are the people who let out the paddy fields. So, at that time, they generally inquire into the thing and find that they have let out the paddy allotment. And
but they should, in that case, if they have broken the contract, they should be evicted from the land.
Yes, but in reality, that is also not possible.
Why?
They live in the scheme.
Mm-hmm.
So, eviction would mean that you are creating a further problem.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it a defect in the ordinance that they haven't had some sort of intermediate punishment? The punishment seems to be only a question of eviction, which is a serious punishment.
That's a very, very important and significant thing in the ordinance. Very important thing because I feel there should definitely be intermediate punishment.
But now say, one form of intermediate punishment is a fine. But for a person in that condition, a fine would be a rather putting worse into the muck, you see, if a fine.
Yes, but unless it could be a nominal fine, where it won't harass the man so much.
Yeah, but then it will lose its purpose, maybe it's only nominal. And if it doesn't affect him, he won't mind breaking the condition.
Yes, but in fixing the fine, this can be taken into consideration, and the amount could be such that he is not harassed too much, but at the same time, he feels that he has to pay the fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is very obvious in many instances. Now, say for instance, people encroach and cultivate tobacco. Now, a tobacco crop produces so much in income, so they just don't mind paying by 10 rupees or 50 rupees or even 100 rupees if they are fine, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because the return is so good.
Why is tobacco cultivation spreading? Is it spreading, tobacco cultivation?
Oh, yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is one of the cultivations which has caught on very well in Ceylon.
In colonization schemes?
In colonization schemes, in B schemes, on private land.
Dry zone? Oh, I see.
That is because the organization is very good. Ceylon Tobacco Company.
Oh, I see.
They
encourage smallholders to do
it? Oh, yes. They encourage them to cultivate it and then their former assistance, the way they give it and the their marketing of the leaf, etc., the arrangements are very good.
I see. So here again you see an example of how capital and organization
works.
Where you feel that you want to evict a villager, because you're a sharecropped or because you're doing something, is it very difficult to collect evidence?
It is generally difficult.
Mm-hmm. What if, say, someone else, an enemy, brings, comes forward and gives you fairly good evidence? Do you really go to the length of evicting that person?
One thing on breach of this condition, letting out the field,
yes,
we do not see it so seriously because, as I said before, we will be creating another problem. It is true that this man is not cultivating the land himself and as a result he doesn't get the income. But there is a bigger problem for him than that, a place to stay, to live in. So, along with the, you know, if you cancel and reject him, he will have no place to go again.
But in the case of village expansion scheme, he could go back to his village as agricultural labourer or something like
that? Yes, but in village expansion schemes, generally this sharecropping is not very common.
Oh, I see. Yes, of course.
It's mostly in colonization schemes.
Mm-hmm. That clears a lot of doubts I had. What about the question of a single nominated heir? Is that still prevalent?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do they dislike this?
Now, that's all. It's rather difficult to answer in the sense. Now, in areas around towns,
mm-hmm,
where there's a terrific scarcity of land, and where the land is used for housing,
mm-hmm,
the general tendency is that they would prefer breaking up the land into smaller units.
Mm-hmm.
But in colonization schemes it is not so, because they feel that by division of the land they wouldn't get at a certain stage a sufficient income for them to live on.
They realize it.
They realize it.
Mm-hmm. But to what extent is there conceived subdivision of the land among different heirs? Do they in practice divide the land? Though they dominate only one person, but in practice cultivate it separately? Or have a conceived tatumaru arrangement?
No, they don't have tatumaru arrangement, but there are instances where the members of the family,
mm-hmm,
divide up the land and cultivate.
Mm-hmm. And you don't object to that sort of thing?
We don't object to it.
But then again it's defeating the purposes of the land.
It may be difficult, but if he does not do that, invariably he has to let out the land to an outsider. Rather than allowing that man to give out the parish land to an outsider,
mm-hmm,
it is preferable if the members of the family themselves cultivate it.
And I think the point you raised earlier about technological change also bears on this.
Yes.
If they are cultivating it more intensively...
Right. That happens. So they would use more fertilizer. Now, originally, if there was one family that was cultivating the parish field,
five acres, with
the growing up children, if two children also, married children also enter into the thing, then they would divide up the 5 acres amongst themselves and cultivate it. So they will find the extent is not so large, so they will use more intensive methods. And they are being three families instead of one, they are also in a better position to buy the fertilizer and use it. And then there will be more labor for intensive cultivation.
Farmer who has gone into this colonization scheme, is against this condition on the whole and said that it led to family disputes. Was that your experience?
It has been my experience. Now that is, that could be clearly seen if you go to Minipal stage 1, the old colony, that's about 25 years old now. There are plenty of disputes because of it.
What about village expansion?
Village expansion, generally the subdivision does not take place. Hmm?
Small lots?
Yes, they are small lots and they are generally highland lots. And there again, now, in places like Kandy district, with the growth of the demand for land, they go on acquiring private land and distributing in small units. In the dry zone areas and other places where there's land is plentiful,
mm-hmm,
therefore further land could be alienated.
Mm-hmm. Village expansion, you said it's mainly highland. What do they grow on?
They start with annual crops, vegetables and things like that. Then they follow up with bananas and the plantains. Then eventually they put some permanent crop. It should do best. Now in the Sigiri area, many people have planted lime. Lime does very well there.
Mm-hmm.
In areas where coconut would grow, they put coconut.
Mm-hmm. Question of this disputes and litigation. It is true that you get disputes and litigation from this condition of primogeniture, or, you know, of 1 year. But sometimes in the communalistic villages where they divide the land, just because they're dividing the land also sometimes you get disputes, don't you?
Yes. But my experience has been that if the disputes are not really by division of the land, but the disputes are due to domestic differences, and those give rise to the disputes, resulting in ultimately in a dispute over the land. Now say for instance, the father and the son were cultivating the land. For some reason or the other, they fell out. Then the father will try to get rid of the son, or the son will try to get rid of the father.
Mm-hmm.
That's very common.
So then it's nothing to do with this condition of nominated there?
No, it is not so much. It doesn't give so much on the condition of the nominated there. It is really, they work peacefully on the land jointly as long as things are all right. But if some dispute arises due to an entirely different matter, a private matter, domestic problem, then of course the question of the land rises. And invariably, that is put forward.
As a, so one has to get to the root of the matter?
Yes.
Because if it is not this condition that is causing disputes and something else, then
yes,
there's nothing we can say against it.
As long as the family gets on well, they get together and do the cultivation. But the trouble arises when they fall out.
What happens when a daughter is nominated and she marries a non-cultivator?
Well, under the land development ordinance, once you alienate a land, then there is very little you can do, provided the conditions are stuck to. So any subsequent changes. Now say for instance, now a landless peasant gets a land today, he gets a permit. Then tomorrow, he gets a sweep. Well, you can do nothing about it. He retains the land.
And he probably sharecrops the thing or something like that.
Well, I suppose there have been instances.
But then in that case, you could evict him.
But
if he
breaks the condition. But as long as he puts up a house on that land and he lives in the house and he maintains the building, in other words, satisfies all the conditions of the permit,
yes,
then you can't, you have no way of cancellation. Although it would appear that he is not deserving.
Hmm. What about this eighth question here? The question, you know, the long quotation there.
But in the land development ordinance, as far as possible, they have tried to keep as close as possible to the village traditions, except for this question of nomination of a single successor.
Mm-hmm. And this question, he implies that the idea of independent individualist peasant proprietor was far away from the traditional village system. But while the village system had many communalistic aspects, by the 20th century weren't the peasants very independent minded in certain ways?
They were. It's a question which sort of cannot be sort of answered
with rigid classification.
With rigid classification. The conditions were different. You see, as we discussed at lunch also, now then the conditions were so different. The numbers were small,
mm-hmm,
the families were small. So whatever the land they had, without any disputes, they could have communally worked it.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have, you know, these old systems of Tattumaru and the famous thing, what do you call it now?
Mulkati?
No.
Katum?
Like this Shramadana, the village is now saying, for instance, I worked on your land and you came and helped me on my land in turn.
Mm-hmm.
So, since then, of course, the problems have become so different. No?
And you feel that it would be impossible to maintain this communalistic aspects, communal aspects?
Yes, because Now the position is the population has definitely increased,
mm-hmm.
and the amount of land that is available in any locality is not by itself sufficient to support the entire population. Then of course for the population itself there are so many avenues. Now in a village, in the past, in the old days, when everybody was a cultivator,
mm-hmm.
but today it is not so. In every family you will get one cultivator, one teacher, one minor employee in a government department. So that naturally it's not all the members who get on the land.
Mm-hmm. I see. And from what farmer says, he would imply that even in colonization schemes, the betma system is practicable. Is it?
In fact, it is in practice now.
It is in practice?
It is in practice now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, say for instance, in schemes like Kantalai in Trincomalee district, generally tank schemes, which during certain seasons, due to the drought, do not collect sufficient water, they are compelled to do a betma cultivation.
The government officers see to it?
Yes. It's organized by the government officers who are in charge. Now, say for instance, Kandalam in Nambulla.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Last year, there wasn't sufficient water in the tank for a full cultivation. There was sufficient water only for 600 acres.
What was the tank?
The Kandalam in Nambulla.
Well, that's good. In other ways, how far do colonists continue this tradition of reciprocal and mutual obligation to each other, helping each other? Do they?
They do. Now, they follow the traditional, now say in transplanting, they get together and do the transplanting.
I suppose you can't get it in the initial years, but gradually as they become friendlier, they...
Yes, they. Once they, as they are settled, of course, if they are settled from different areas, they won't know each other, but there is gradually settlement, they come to know each other and they organize it.
What about the case of widespread colonies, or rather colonies which have scattered flocks all over the area? Can you expect close cooperation? That sort of colony.
Of course, now you don't get that to the ideal limit as you would find in a village, because that is a very homogeneous society. But in a colonization scheme, all forms of people come from all places.
Mm-hmm. In fact, what has been your experience about caste barriers in the colonization
scheme?
Do they operate?
They do. They do operate elsewhere in Ceylon.
Yes.
So that as much as they operate there, they operate in the colonization schemes as well.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't this hinder the colony?
It does. Mm-hmm. That is why actually, I mean, this collective activity is not possible. That is the biggest hindrance. In reality, it doesn't come to the surface so much, but it's always there underneath.
Mm-hmm. But I thought sometimes, at least in recent years, government officers have tried to get homogeneous units in colonies. They haven't.
They have tried it some time ago. At the time of settlement, if any particular lot of people like to live together, then they were put in possession of the land together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is being even followed now, but in a way that is also not too desirable. You are, in other words, only propagating the same evil.
So on the whole, you would say that when you and others chose people, you didn't take caste at all into consideration?
No, we didn't take caste at all into consideration unless it came as a request from the settlers. There again, it was not the question of caste was not put forward,
mm-hmm.
but they generally say that, well, so many of us who came from such a village wish to live together. In such instances, we put them together, because it was their wish and felt that they would get along better.
But surely, since Goigama class predominates in Ceylon, there must be many cases of colonies in which the persons are solely of one caste.
Incidentally, I don't know whether you're correct that the Goigama predominates. I don't know. No, I have really not done
anything.
I don't know.
Oh, I see. No,
I really don't know it.
Oh, if they don't, then it's different.
But in fact, I do not think that they are in a majority.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought that traditionally they were a majority. I'm applying a Cambrian kingdom idea into the...
But of course, this is a question I have never looked into.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that the Goigama were in a minority. Anyway, that is just a feeling and I do not know.
And how, just jumping to another state, how unpopular have these land grants been? This form of tenure, do they, as you said earlier, they want to be left alone a bit more. But would you say that this form of LGO grant is unpopular?
No, it's not unpopular at all.
Mm-hmm.
Only thing is, today anybody walking into any colonization scheme, any stranger who has no experience of colonization would feel that the people are being made to suffer like anything. But it is not in reality so. And somehow the general tendency has been also that whenever any outsider goes into a scheme, always the colonies will come out with their difficulties and complaints. Well, I heard that nearly 13 years of experience, over 13 years of experience of colonization, I have never come across a colonist who would stand up and say, thank God, I am now like this. I didn't have an inch of land in the village.
They never
tell you. I don't know why it is. At least they do not tell it to the officers who have a dealing with them.
So they are always on the sort of pessimistic side.
Always.
And complain.
That's a strange fact that I have always observed. They are very pessimistic about it, at least to us who have dealings in this field. But I know, in their heart of hearts, definitely their condition has been better.
Mm-hmm. What about this restrictions on borrowing money on the security of the land? I thought that is unfortunate. They would like to borrow money.
That may be, but now there are plenty of facilities for loans from government through their MPCS.
Do they use them?
They use them, but the only difficulty is they don't repay the loans in Africa. They are not in a position to get further loans. People who repay their loans in time have absolutely no difficulty. And that is definitely, that definitely helps them, the loans.
Farmer tries to make out that it's unpopular because this type of land and all its conditions and all is something which they are never used to. And it's not customary.
But I suppose the main purpose then in having these restrictions, these certain conditions, particularly with regard to things like getting a loan on the land,
yes,
was purposely put in to prevent the peasant from being deprived of the land.
That's right.
The present is such that the first opportunity they get to mortgage the land and get some money, they will certainly do so. You wouldn't think twice about the loss of the land.
Why is that? This is a rather queer feature. The Singhalese are so attached to land,
yes. Yet
they are careless to the way they handle it.
Yes. It is a strange fact.
Frankly, I disagree with Farmer because, and with Leach in particular, because I think they are trying to get the best of both worlds. You can't save the peasant from his own improvidence and have something wholly popular.
You can't. In fact, a condition of that type where they can lease or mortgage the land would be most welcome by these authorities, but it would be disastrous. A majority of them will be deprived of their lands if that happens. Today, I should think all these LD allotments, they remain because of that one condition. Otherwise, majority would have gone off.
So in other words, this 13th question I have asked you, whether it kept the peasants, the land of the peasants away from land sharks, moneylenders, etc., etc., you think it has?
It has.
So it
has served the purpose. And I think one of the main intentions at that time was to protect this peasant from the sharks.
Another question regarding the ordinance itself, looking at the terms and the clauses and so on and so forth, do you think it was too complicated and too detailed?
No, it's, I think, one of the simplest bits of legislation.
Oh, I see, that's very useful. And
very clear cut.
You know, you didn't feel that it went into too great detail and should have left you with more freedom?
No, but it's a very small bit of legislation.
Oh, I see. That's very useful. I was interested in that aspect. Wider aspect is the question of practicability. Can you, given the aims of preventing sharecropping, preventing subdivision, preventing it passing away into the hands of outsiders, could you, and also enforcing good cultivation, could you really enforce it? Have we got enough DLOs and enough officers to check on all these lands and to see that everything is done?
I mean, the staff available is not enough for such a rigid check, uh-huh. But we still have sufficient control.
For instance, is there a difference between the control you exercise at the permit stage and the grant stage? By law there is But, you know, the Brahmic stage, the first stage when...
Yes, now, according to the ordinance, those two stages are there also because of that. Now, they expect, I believe, a certain amount of fallouts.
Yes.
Now, it may be that a certain percentage will not make good on the land. That is why straight away they are not given a grant. But a certain amount of test is enforced. And thereafter, if they show signs that they will make good on the land, then they will, once they develop the land to a certain degree, then a grant is issued.
Mm-hmm. Does that test work?
It does.
Some people abandon the land.
Some people abandon the
land. And what do you do then?
Then we realignate it.
Mm-hmm. What if they sort of neglect the land but work on it a bit and, you know, hardly put in any effort? If they put up...